Hong Kong and Singapore and everybody else, is Hong Kong the right place for you to set up your company? Episode number 104, Global from Asia.
Welcome to the Global from Asia podcast, where the daunting process of running an international business from Hong Kong is broken down into straight up actionable advice. And now, your host, Michael Michelini.
Cooling down here in South China, my wife bought me a brand new light jacket, and it's got the proper daddy feel. Can't believe I'm two months away from baby number two. It's going to be a girl. It's amazing being a parent. It's a really amazing journey. I was really afraid a little bit going into it, but I highly recommend being a parent if you have a chance. And we just need to keep on pushing forward. I'm finally happy to announce I have a proper dedicated office in Hong Kong, and I'm going to be spending a few days a week there while I have to keep the family back in China. I will be coming to Hong Kong, I think, each week. I'm still kind of sorting out the schedule, but Mondays until Wednesdays, and I'm going to have a little bit of a small party meetup at my new office on Tuesday night, November 24th, from 7 p.m. to about 9 p.m., do a live interview of a podcast there. I also have some other friends in town. For full details, check out globalfromasia.com/office-opening. Okay, enough of the soft stuff. Let's get into the meat of this week's show. We have with us a good one, comparing Singapore and Hong Kong, which are often top choices in Asia, as well as other options around the world for where to set up your business. We have Edmund John. He is a wealth of information and knowledge on international corporations and passports, and a friend of mine for a few years here. So we're going to dive right into the interview. Before I get started, we didn't even do the proper introduction of him, so I'm going to just read it off right now so that you guys know. As a registered agent and professional intermediary in several jurisdictions, he develops apps to help entrepreneurs compare options for incorporation and residency. His work is at the intersection of law and technology and can be found at corporations.io, passports.io, and his blog, flagtheory.com. Okay, now without further ado, let's jump right into the questions. I know we've been talking a little bit before the before we're recording here, but Hong Kong and Singapore, I don't want to pigeonhole you as a Singapore guy, but you definitely know it more than I do. So it's a kind of a hot topic a lot of times I see in different forums or people are asking me an email. So maybe first, before we even jump into Singapore and Hong Kong, what are some of the variables that an individual should think about beforehand? Like, you know, American sure.
Great question. There's just so many. And American is probably the top one. You know, if you're American, you sort of get the privilege to file a lot of different paperwork for owning any type of company outside of America, especially if you're the main shareholder in that company, because it'll be designated by the IRS as what's called a CFC, or at least it's likely that it would be designated by the IRS as a CRC. But anyway, moving beyond the American stuff, just the disclaimer there that if you are American, this stuff does get more complicated, and ownership in a foreign company probably is something where you'd want to talk to a lawyer, tax accountant, and your priest before you undertook that arduous process.
Priest is the most important.
As to Americans in Asia, Mike and myself, and ones that have owned a number of different companies here, your question is, how do you determine which jurisdiction might be best for you as an entrepreneur when you're setting up a jurisdiction? I'd say there's many different factors, but probably you'd want to look at what's the best for your individual business. And you determine that by looking at things like, what do you need to do with this business in the next 5 years? Is this a business that you're going to want to raise capital for? Is this something that's more of a lifestyle business and you're going to have some profit, which is left over at the end of each year, which perhaps you'd want to do some tax planning so that the effective corporate tax rate in the jurisdiction which you set up the company is low, or as low as it can be legally. You'd want to look at things like, what are the local requirements? Does this require a local director or a local secretary? You'd want to look at things like, what is the minimum number of directors or shareholders? This is something that you as a sole owner are going to be involved with. Perhaps a jurisdiction which has LLC laws might be better for you, because LLCs afford more protection than a limited company in some instances for a single shareholder or single member in the case of an LLC. So that's just kind of the start of it, I guess.
There's tons. And like you said, I'm always also afraid to give general generic advice to anyone online, right? It totally depends on who's this person specifically listening, right? Their situation themselves is a big factor on choosing the right business and corporation. But maybe first also, like, why is, so it seems like Singapore and Hong Kong are, I would say, at least in Asia-based businesses, the top two, right? And maybe give us a high-level reason why that would be true?
I think there's a lot, but I think if you look at Hong Kong and Singapore, they are traditionally banking centers, which is obviously very important for doing business, but they're also jurisdictions which are common law jurisdictions in an area of the world where typically you're having many different types of laws and languages, quite frankly. And in, you know, Hong Kong maybe is an exception to this, but in Singapore, all of the laws and company documents are going to be in English. And because of that, I think that you'll find it is much easier to do business in the English language, especially if you're a native English speaker. I guess another reason would be that traditionally they have very fast and good court systems. So they're protective of minority shareholding rights in a way that, you know, not to pick on Indonesia, but Indonesia is just not. You know, if you're going to do business in Indonesia, it's almost par for the course, so to speak, to set up a holding company in Singapore so that you have the ability to take on investment, you have that access to strong banking, and you have, you know, a very developed country in which you can base, you know, the headquarters of your operations. And Hong Kong being similar in respect to operating through China, you know, it's very important to have that banking center and the ability to transfer money freely where there's not a country with capital controls. You know, doing business in China, it's very difficult to transfer money around. And Hong Kong is quite the opposite. It's probably the easiest country in the world in which to send money in and out of with a company bank account. So I guess that's starters, what I'd say.
True. I know there's tons, but yeah, I guess I totally agree. I mean, I'm more on in the China side, recording even today inside of mainland, barely. But yeah, exactly. Like these other, a lot of these other Asian, you know, countries are very, I guess, politically correct word would be red tape and slow. So seems like these, you know, Singapore and Hong Kong definitely have much less of the red tape, and they're a little bit more based on Western legal systems and more, and speed is more important there too. So, and I think also they can be fully foreign owned, right? Now, I think you might've mentioned that, but you don't have to have local partners. I mean, I think in China there is Chinese wholly foreign owned entities, but you know, I think in Singapore, Hong Kong, it's definitely fully foreign owned, doesn't have to have local influence.
Sure. Well, just to continue to pick on Indonesia, there are ownership restrictions in this country where it's difficult for foreign investment or direct foreign investment to occur, especially in an entity where you'd want to have control over that, over the shares and the shareholding votes. So I think that if you are doing business in an emerging market or developing market, oftentimes the laws may not be advanced as a developed nation. And perhaps using an operating company and a holding company structure can be effective. You know, lots of times, at least the people that I've come across will use a wholly foreign owned entity, a WFOE, as sometimes it's called in China, and then they'll also have an entity in Hong Kong. And one thing that you could do is you could have the IP held in Hong Kong, and then you could have kind of the operations and the liability sit in China. And there would be advantages to that type of structure. You could come up with agreements where, you know, the operating company in China provides a service to the holding company in Hong Kong. And if anything happened to that Chinese company, let's say it got sued or ran into local regulation issues, the IP would already be safe and secure offshore outside of China in Hong Kong in this instance. And then you'd be able to shift the operations to a new operating company and a new operating country if you needed to, if it came to that point. So that's another consideration why, you know, you shouldn't look at your legal entity setup in maybe just a box if it has to be this or it has to be that. There's lots of different planning and lots of different options. And Hong Kong and Singapore are two that we're talking about today because they seem to be, you know, widely regarded as the most popular entities that are located within a country in Asia. Obviously, there's other choices like BVI, Belize, offshore companies, but specifically today, speaking about Hong Kong and Singapore, there's some key differences between the two that I think we can get into that might be interesting for people that are listening.
Sure. Yeah, definitely great answers. And I know it's tough with there being so many different factors. I think when we're talking about different, let's maybe go between the two. So I think they can both be foreign owned fully, but then I think there comes up the secretarial and or directors that are requirements between the two. What's the story there, or can you give us some insight if you would?
So I guess the one aspect of a Singapore company that Singapore Private Limited company that is typically a complaint is that it's a requisite by the Accounting Regulatory Authority of Singapore to have a local director in a private limited company. That means that there's someone that has a SingPass, access to the government e-services is really what a SingPass is, that's able to manage the company. Sometimes they set up the company for you. If you're a foreigner, what you'll have to do is you'll have to use a corporate service provider who has access to ACRA. That's ACRA, which is basically the government portal to register a company. You'll have to utilize a corporate services provider. Oftentimes, corporate service providers will also have what's called a nominee director who will maintain some sort of, not only would their name be on the file, but oftentimes the question comes up, well, okay, if I have a nominee director, is this someone that actually has a say in what's going on in the company? And the answer is yes, they do, although you can draft legal agreements to kind of have them resign ahead of time, and you can remove them quite easily. And quite frankly, they probably don't want to have any real directorship over your company, because really all the directorship conveys is a degree of liability. There's no shareholders' rights. There's no rights to profits associated with being a director. You receive, a yearly fee for your services, but that's effectively it for your directorship. So pulling back, I guess, the big difference between Hong Kong and Singapore in terms of the director and secretary requirements is that in both jurisdictions, you're required to have a local secretary, but in Hong Kong, you are not required to have a local director. And that tends to make it a little bit easier and a little bit lower cost overall to have a Hong Kong company as opposed to a Singapore company.
Cool. Yeah, great answer. I'm actually learning about Singapore from this actual call. So it's interesting. And then I think annual filing, a lot of people complain, about Hong Kong's audit requirements. Not sure how that works in Singapore either, but maybe we could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I think that the main, you're not required to be audited in Hong Kong and you're not required to be audited in Singapore except under certain circumstances. So I'll let you speak to the circumstances which you're required to be audited in Hong Kong, but the circumstances which you're required to be audited in Singapore, the main one that people run into is that if you have a corporate shareholder, so this means that if there's a legal entity of some type and not a natural person that's a shareholder in the company, so a company owns your company in Singapore, owns shares in that company, then you would be required to be audited in Singapore. And obviously there's associated cost and preparation of documents that are associated with that. In both jurisdictions, you would be required pretty much irregardless of the company's standards, you'd be required to file accounts on a yearly basis, but that doesn't mean that they would be audited accounts. You'd be required to file an annual return. Maybe you can speak more to that on the
Hong Kong side. Hong Kong is, I've been digging even deeper as I've been developing. And basically the thing is, if they send a profit and tax return request to your address, that's when you need to do an audited tax return. And a lot of times people think of audits, they think of, I guess, the US IRS, where they're kind of like checking everything. What it means in Hong Kong is a certified local CPA goes through and spot checks your books and your P&L and your balance sheet and signs off. So they're basically verifying that the paperwork that you've done is legitimate and correct. So they're basically using their license they're guaranteeing what you're submitting has been checked by them. So some will be more strict than others. And that's where all this gray pricing comes up. Everybody wants to know how much does it cost to do an audit. And it's kind of hard because it depends on how good your books have been kept and how many transactions and things like that. So this is always a headache that people are always asking, wants a fixed price, but right now it's still tricky because there's like manual procedures, and depending on how much digging they gotta do in the books. So that's the quick answer to, again, it's a sticky one.
Yeah, I'd add on two things to that. I guess I would say that first and foremost, it is very tough to get a flat price on any type of accounting work, because this is a service that someone's providing to you. There needs to be someone there that's kind of checking and doing the books. Obviously, services like Xero, or products, I should say, like Xero, that are, are software as a service that streamline that process, can make it quicker and easier. And that's probably the type of account that you should get, is one that is utilizing technology and kind of forward thinking in the way that they're maintaining your books. And I guess another tip to anyone that's listening, if you want to think about how you could make that cost a little bit lower, oftentimes if you're picking the same accountant bookkeeper who's also doing the audit, sometimes they'll give you a break because they've already gone through your books and they already know them. They've already prepared them to some extent. So you will be able to get kind of a lower price for sticking with the same firm for both the accounting and the audit. Some jurisdictions actually don't allow for you to do that, but I don't think that that's a problem in either Singapore or Hong Kong, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I agree. The other tricky part, though, is, well, another tip, I guess, is the secretary has in Hong Kong has a lot of power as a direct, almost as a director with the government. And sometimes if you do the same secretary, bookkeeper, and auditor, they have a lot of leverage, and it's somewhat, I don't want to say hard, but of course it's your choice as a director or owner of the company to change. But sometimes you want to kind of diversify. You maybe could, I agree with the audit and the bookkeeping together, but sometimes the secretary is a third one, all in one. You really need to trust this person and also verify that, you know, maybe when you're price shopping, it might be harder to switch when all three are at the same place.
Sure. I guess, just touching on the corporate secretary, I'm not sure what that would cost in Hong Kong on a yearly basis, but typically around $600 is the going rate in Singapore. And agree that in Singapore also, the corporate secretary is a very important, has a very important job in the company. And in Singapore, you're required to keep a chartered Singaporean accountant, chartered Singaporean secretary, a lot of S's there, in order to maintain the company. And so that's an important consideration when you're picking out a corporate services firm. You know, what is the cost of the corporate secretary? What is that cost covering? Because oftentimes there'll be fees that are kind of added on, you know, for various reasons. If they're needed to add or remove a shareholder, that might be a fee, or it might be included in the specific price that you paid for that $600. So that's something that you'd want to ask as you're kind of going to set up this company. You know, what are the fees associated with the corporate secretary, with the audit, with the accounting, in addition to the registered office and kind of the government fee?
Agree. It's there's so many parts. There's the address that received the mail, then there's the government fees, and there's, at least in Hong Kong, there's like the annual return. There's also like the business registration certificate, and it depending if you have different licenses, if you have special licenses, you got to renew those. So you also got to check if the secretary is including that in their service, or it's just the ability to help you file the annual return and be the secretary. So, and then there's the bookkeeping and the audit. So it's like a bunch of different things that you got to check into.
But it's all worth it because you're an entrepreneur.
Exactly. This is part of the fun. And so now here's a hot one. I think maybe Singapore might be winning here is the banking options. I think one we've been both probably seeing in forums and we've been talking is it's getting a bit difficult, more and more difficult with banking, at least in Hong Kong. But I think everywhere this could be a huge discussion. But maybe talk a little bit about banking options, at least in Singapore with in Hong Kong too, or I could talk about Hong Kong too, or how do you want to handle this whole banking situation now?
Sure. I'll say that banking in Hong Kong 5 years ago was probably the world leader in opening up bank accounts for international companies. And for whatever reason, I think mostly one specific bank who won't name has been denying a lot of accounts. And I think that people have kind of started to look elsewhere. And Singapore has stepped up a little bit into that role to be kind of a leader, especially in the region of Southeast Asia for banking. They've just got really well-capitalized banks, very well-run banks, very private laws that protect the banks from disclosing information about their customers. And indeed, it's still possible to open up a Singapore bank account for a company which is, you know, quote-unquote offshore, say a BVI entity, a Panamanian entity, a Cayman Islands entity. There are banks in Singapore that with the proper introduction and proper paperwork and due diligence requirements obviously fulfilled are willing to open up an account for an offshore company. So I think that in that respect, Singapore is certainly ahead. And I think in terms of the actual online banking access to credit facilities and access to, you know, the range of corporate debit cards and other types of products that you might be needing from a corporate bank, they're pretty much similar. I just think it's become easier to open up a bank account in Singapore. And quite frankly, I enjoy banking there. So I don't know what your opinion is on Hong Kong.
Yeah, so of course, Hong Kong used to be, like you said, 5 years ago, we could go in with shorts and flip-flops and you know, minimum documentation and get a pretty much guaranteed approved in a few days. But now everybody's wearing, I'm telling people wear suits and bring like proof of business and documents and business plans and all kinds of stuff. So it's definitely getting harder. And I can't speak for Singapore or other places really, but I think it's just because the U.S., you know, different security bureaus are fining banks and for not doing KYC or enough, which is know your customers, and not verifying that they're not doing money laundering or drug trafficking or other, you know, bad businesses. But I don't know about you, Edmund, but I wonder, how do people know, how can the banks really know? Of course, I could open up and say I do one business and do it to another, but it seems like certain governments are making it responsibility on the banks to know what the transactions are in the banks of their clients.
Well, if you look at the banking requirements, typically there's two different sets of legal requirements that they're required to adhere by. There's the Know Your Customer, which you mentioned, KYC, and that's a series of checks to make sure that this person is who they say they are. They're not a politically connected individual, and they're not involved with money laundering or terrorist activities. I guess the other check that's kind of more of an ongoing check is the AML requirements, in which case, you know, some accounts are closed or should be closed if they meet specific signs of suspicious activity. And these, you know, banks are required to file what's called a SAR, or suspicious activity report, if they see any indications of money laundering or illegal activity. And so there is a lot of pressure on banks from regulators to not only, you know, not have these clients, and it's somewhat unfortunate that the banks don't always get to choose, you know, if their client does illegal activities. Oftentimes that's the decision of the client, not of the bank. Sometimes the bank is complicit, but I'd say that's the exception rather than the rule. And this is why it's become more difficult to open up a bank account, is because these banks are not necessarily viewing you as an asset on their balance sheet, but potentially could be a liability, so to speak. I'm speaking metaphorically here, but you know, if you do something illegal that causes the bank to incur liability, then obviously that's damaging not only to their reputation, but also potentially to the bottom line if they're fined for that activity. So these are why the banks are making it more difficult. And you know, certainly there are jurisdictions in which it's easier to open up a bank account. Hong Kong is on the more difficult end of the spectrum right now, and I'd say Singapore is somewhere in the middle. And then there's plenty of offshore banks that are still relatively easy to open up an account. But for me personally, I've definitely seen a lot more business in the past 1 or 2 years in terms of people having a legal entity already and just looking for banking introduction because they were either denied or weren't unable to find a bank that took on their business. And so it's become much more difficult to set up a bank account internationally, almost anywhere across the board. That's for sure.
Yeah, I agree. I think we'll see how the future holds. I don't know if you have predictions or not, but I guess this might get harder. I don't know.
I think that what we'll see is we'll see competition coming from emerging technologies like cryptocurrencies or other alternative finance or fintech options, which make it easier for banks to process KYC, you know, potentially remotely. And then on the other side, you'll have kind of these disruptive companies where they're kind of existing in somewhat, you know, outside the regulations that a bank might have to adhere to. You know, no one has to get permission to sign up for Bitcoin. It's censorship proof. And that's sort of one of the most disruptive aspects of the specific cryptocurrency Bitcoin, is that no one has to give you permission to sign up for this network. It's a permissionless blockchain. And if you look at other blockchains that banks are actually experimenting with, because they see this as potentially disrupting to their core service lines, banks, including DBS, including major banks in Asia, Citibank, there's a consortium over 20 banks that have joined a group called R3CV, who's working on a blockchain technology in the US. Right now, it's a very, very hot topic in fintech, is blockchain technology and how they can provide potential efficiencies for banks to be able to improve on their current lines of service, as well as offer potentially new lines of service, or be able to find efficiencies in a system which currently, you know, has inefficiencies. So something like a bond, you know, bond syndicates. Obviously, those take, maybe not obviously, but those take a very long time to clear. It can take, say, 20 days or more. And oftentimes banks are coming up with synthetic instruments to represent bonds. And that's why, you know, blockchain technology could potentially help clear these specific asset classes a lot quicker. Maybe we don't need to go down that rabbit hole.
This is interesting, definitely. But yeah, let's hope they disrupt, or at least make it easier for business owners to get normal bank accounts at least. But it's a pretty cool technology. Here's a good one. I think you'd be great at answering, is raising money, fundraising for venture backed startups or those targeting to be venture backed? I think we both know or will agree on the winner here, but what maybe you can answer?
I think the winner here is probably Delaware C Corp in Silicon Valley. But if we're sticking to Asia,
true.
I think that Singapore probably has a little bit more activity in the venture capital arena. And I think that largely that's because of government influence in Singapore to foster an ecosystem of entrepreneurship. There's really a fantastic program started by the government of Singapore called the Technology Incubation Scheme. And I think that some really good companies kind of came out of that. But that also created an ecosystem where many different, there's other programs that the NRF started, the National Research Foundation started, where they'll match fund kind of one-to-one or different ratios. And basically they'll say, okay, you're a venture capitalist fund, come set up in Singapore. We've got these flow of companies. They've already been seeded. You know, come invest in these in the Series A. This is also the ESVF plan. There's various different incentives that the Singapore government provides to early stage startups, you know, on the financing and grants and different areas of finance that are useful for a company kind of that's fledgling, just getting its wings underneath itself and trying to take off. So I think that Singapore is a little bit ahead of Hong Kong in terms of the VC game. However, I do think that there's some value add angels in Hong Kong. And I don't think that Hong Kong is to be disregarded. When I was at Rise, we were both at Rise, actually.
Yep.
I did feel like there was more activity than there's been in the past in Hong Kong in the early stage venture
Definitely
scene. And I think
agree.
It'll continue to go that way. And I actually think that Hong Kong has a lot more potential for early stage angels than Singapore does, just because Hong Kong is sort of, you know, so interconnected to China that inevitably there's going to be high net worth individuals coming from China and looking to invest in early stage startups. And I think that a lot of that could potentially happen through the form of you know, crowdfunding or crowdfunding for equity or these kind of secondary markets that have come about. Lately, I met one company that was doing that there. I think that that's, you know, there's a good potential for that in Hong Kong as well as Singapore. But I think that right now the VC game is probably, we're going to have to give the edge to Singapore.
Yeah, I know. It's fair. It's fair. Agreed. But yeah, I do feel like Hong Kong is catching up a little bit. It seemed like they were kind of just sleeping for a few years, but I think the last couple have been picking up. There's incubators popping up everywhere, and you know, there's tons of co-working. I think that's more like a real estate play, but which kind of goes into the next question is the living, you know, quality of life, living situations. I think I've only been in Singapore a couple of times just for short conferences, but they're both very comfortable first world, you know, place living, right? I mean, how do you think about Singapore? And I think they're equally as expensive, right? They're probably one of the more expensive places in the world to live.
Yeah, I mean, they are certainly more expensive places comparatively. However, I do think that they provide pretty good value, both of them. They're easy to get around with public transportation. I think that they've got good systems and bodies of law. Put it this way, it's a pretty safe place to raise a family, either one of them. And Singapore, in my mind, is one of the safest places in the world. And I've lived there for a year, so maybe I'm biased towards Singapore, but I very much enjoyed my time there. And I found that it was a city with multicultural background where I didn't feel like a Singaporean race was, you know, just like this. Like Singaporean Chinese is probably the predominant race in Singapore. However, it's by no means the vast majority of people in Singapore are Singapore Chinese. You'll find many different races and backgrounds there. And I think that Singaporeans in general tend to be fairly accepting of different backgrounds. It just has a culture and a history of being accepted to expats. Obviously, that kind of swings in different directions depending on which political party is in power. However, I do think that Singapore is a great place to live, and I feel a little bit more comfortable interacting on a day-to-day basis in Singapore than I do in Hong Kong, just not being fluent in Cantonese is a little bit of a drawback for me being in Hong Kong.
I guess I can't speak too much. I always like to joke about Singapore is I can't chew gum there or I can't buy gum. That's always my joke. And this seems much very, very strict, right? But very, very clean. And is that a law? The gum thing, do you know?
I mean, you actually can't necessarily buy gum in a convenience store. But for me, that's it's not so much of an impact in my day-to-day life.
True. I know it's more like a joke, but it's just like something that always stuck out to me.
I do feel like it's unfortunate that Singapore has this, you know, kind of somewhat draconian image to the outside world. And I can tell you that living there, you don't feel like that. It does feel like a very free society. And for the most part, you're just left alone. It's not something where there's a police state where you find police on every corner, you know, wielding machine guns. This is really something where, for the most part, you're left alone. But I do feel like there is a rule of law in Singapore where if someone wrongs you, you are able to file a lawsuit and kind of get some sort of repercussion based on that wrongdoing. And that's something that I feel like Singapore and Hong Kong have a great deal of advantage over other countries in the region, which might not have as strong of a body of law. And really, the in this case, we're talking about shareholder protections aren't really afforded the same rights as they probably should be.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, yeah, so I can't really compare it to Singapore too much, but I mean, I was just on a junk boat trip a couple of Saturdays ago, and it's pretty, you know, the cool thing at least about Hong Kong is you can go to the beach in like an hour from the financial district, and if you don't even see like a skyscraper, and you feel like you're in another totally area. And but of course, some of the negatives, just to be fair, is you know, a lot of people complain about pollution coming up. I don't know. Actually, Singapore's has some issues with pollution sometimes, what I've heard in the news. But you know, Hong Kong is kind of getting more pollution. But and also, of course, everybody heard the Occupy Hong Kong or Occupy Central protests a year ago, where you know, there's this political unrest or some tension between some of the local residents and maybe central government. And actually, a lot of people have always asked me the risks of having a company in Hong Kong with these things coming up. But, you know, I guess my answer to that is, you know, I think it's still like talking about 10 or 20 years in the future. These protests are about the future. So for now, I think we're fine. And I think the worst case for corporate is you know, they might have to move in 10 or 20 years. I mean, but I really don't think mainland China is gonna like be that abrupt and take that kind of risk with you know, because they have a lot of investments too in Hong Kong. If they were to mess around with the financials or the corporate structures, you know, I think the whole economy would be at risk. So I'm not too concerned about that. And my next point is residency, which I think you're another expert at, Edmund, is you know, where can people get like passports or residencies as expats? And do you want to speak for, I mean, you have a whole website about this, but do you want to maybe speak a little bit briefly about Singapore?
Sure. That website would be passports.io. Basically, what it does is compare different jurisdictions. So looking at Singapore, you know, one of the probably best ways for an entrepreneur listening to this podcast to receive a residency and potentially an eventual citizenship in Singapore would be through the EntrePass program. I've actually gone through this program myself, so I know a lot about it. And effectively what this means is that you're going to Singapore, you're looking to set up a business which will be in existence for the next few years, and you're going to hire a certain number of employees in Singapore. The regulations and requirements for those employees and kind of the ongoing requirements for EntrePass have increased in previous years. However, in the gist of the program is that you can go to Singapore, and that if you are able to abide by the requirements within 3 years, you can actually become a permanent resident or a citizen in Singapore. Now, the interesting thing about Singaporean citizenship is that they do not recognize dual nationality, so you'd be renouncing whatever other citizenship that you might hold if you're becoming a Singaporean citizen. However, I know people that have done that, and you know, certainly it's an option potentially. I guess that there's some other passes that are capable of taking expats or foreigners in Singapore. Typically, if you're moving there and relocating and being employed by a company, you'd be on an employment pass. And there's kind of, in essence, three different levels of employment pass. And if you're an investor, then there are different investment schemes which can allow you to receive residency, permanent residency, or even citizenship on say a quicker timeline, so to speak. But for entrepreneurs that are listening to this podcast, EntrePass is a fairly straightforward and reasonable option. And maybe a final option for immigration in Singapore would be a PEP, a personal employment pass. This is more for consultants or individuals who are going to be working in a foreign in a company as a foreigner in Singapore, but they're not going to be owning their shares in their own company, which is really what the EntrePass is for. In fact, one of the requirements for EntrePass is that you own at least 30% of the company in which you're running. I wrote a whole article on EntrePass at flagtheory.com / EntrePass. If people are more interested, maybe we link that in the comments.
Sure, we'll put that
in there. What's the scoop on Hong Kong? How easy is it to become a resident?
I'm actually going through the process right now. I wish I did this when I eat. It's crazy. It's been 8 years, but I was always getting told to apply for residency. But the quick answer is similar. Seems similar to Singapore, where, of course, there's either employment visa or investment visa. And now there's a new one called the Entrepreneur Investment Visa, which is what I'm applying for. I think it's been around for about 6 months or maybe a year now. And so they're like we're talking about with the investment scene, they're trying much more lately to get innovation here and entrepreneurs. So it's, I don't want to say easier, but it's, they're definitely looking more at, you know, are you bringing innovations to the market? So once you get either employment visa or an investment visa or this new entrepreneur investment visa, you will get a Hong Kong ID card, which is a resident card, but you won't be a permanent resident until you hold it for 7 years. Then you'll be a permanent resident, and that won't be able to replace your passport in your home country, but that basically allows you to not have to remain in Hong Kong. You know, you just have to visit, I think, every few years. I don't want to be quoted on how long, but you do have to come back sometimes. And you get the benefits of, like, the educational system and healthcare system and you know, being able to vote in Hong Kong as a resident.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I think more broadly speaking, we're going to see more governments around the world providing schemes and providing incentives for entrepreneurs specifically to come and set up a business there. I think that traditionally we've seen, you know, citizenship by investment schemes become a success, but now we're starting to see a second wave where also entrepreneurship schemes are becoming available to not just investors, but entrepreneurs at potentially a lower level of total investment, but more requirements in terms of what are the amount of jobs created, or you know, what are you actually going to be doing in the country while you're here? Is this something where you're just buying a property and sitting on it? Probably that's not going to be acceptable for most entrepreneurship schemes. However, there are, you know, different paths in different countries. New Zealand is an interesting one to look at as a comparison, where they have two levels of investment scheme. They have an investor and an investor plus, and they also have an entrepreneur and an entrepreneur plus. And depending on which category you fit in, they have a different timeline to a permanent residency and citizenship. So that tends to be the main benefit that these countries are offering in terms for their, you know, investment in the country, either direct investment in the form of buying property, buying bonds, buying a house. Typically that's under an investment scheme, or starting a business under an entrepreneurship scheme.
Yep. Yeah, this is awesome. I mean, so thanks so much, Edmund, for coming on. And yeah, this has been fascinating for me, and I'm sure listeners are got a whole notebook full of notes or hopefully they pulled over if they're in their car or whatever they are. And so maybe how can people find you online, and, you know, what are you up to? What are some of your projects? I know you do a lot of amazing things. So maybe you can share it with listeners interested.
Sure. Something that I've just kind of put together is incorporations.io. So just like it's spelled, incorporations with an S.io. And that's a company matrix tool that allows you to kind of compare side by side different jurisdictions to incorporate a company, and then be able to click according to your own personal preferences, certain things which you'd want to include or exclude. Like if you don't want to have a local corporate secretary, maybe Singapore or Hong Kong isn't right for you. And that would kind of give you a choice and different list of options. And then we connect to different registered agents and corporate service providers and law firms in those various jurisdictions and enable our customers to kind of set up a company there. So that's one thing I'm working on. And I guess the other project I'm working on is passports.io, just like it's spelled passports.io. And that allows people to explore different citizenship and entrepreneurship investment schemes where, you know, you'd be able to receive permanent residency or residency on the way to citizenship in different jurisdictions around the world, and basically be able to compare what are the initial investment requirements, what are the ongoing requirements, and then be able to make an informed decision based on all your choices on where the best jurisdiction is for you. And then kind of where that's tied together is flag30.com, where I write about these issues more as a blog. And yeah, but Mike, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
No problem. My pleasure. Thanks, Edmund, again for coming on and sharing. I even learned quite a few things today, and more on certain things on Singapore especially and other programs out there. So I hope everybody else got a lot out of it. I'm sure they did. And send Edmund a thank you for me. So that's all we have for this week's show. If you enjoy these podcasts, I really do love and read the reviews on iTunes. You can go ahead and do that if you're comfortable. at globalfromasia.com/iTunes. And there's going to be a tab on the iTunes page for ratings and reviews. Click that, sign into your Apple account, and leave a review. And also, just a reminder again, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, if you're going to be locally in Hong Kong in a neighborhood on Tuesday, November 24th, I'd love to meet up. 7 p.m. at my office in TST or Tsim Sha Tsui Kowloon District. For all the details and directions and to RSVP, go to globalfromasia.com/office-opening. It's going to be a fun night to remember, and I hope to see you there. And if not, of course, I'll tune into the next show. And thanks again, everybody, for listening, and have a great day.
To get more info about running an international business via Hong Kong, please visit our website at www.globalfromasia.com. That's www.globalfromasia.com. Also, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes feed. Thanks for tuning in.